Rosinas on Air, the Criminal Compliance Podcast.
Welcome to a new episode of the Criminal Compliance Podcast. My name is Christian Rosinas, and in our today's episode, we are joined by Nikhil Vashne, a very experienced lawyer and partner with KAM from India. Welcome, Nikhil. Nice to speak to you.
Thank you, Christian. Pleasure. Pleasure is entirely mine. And thank you. And I look forward to this podcast, which I know is very famous in your jurisdiction and in the other jurisdictions also. So I'm looking forward to this.
Thank you. The pleasure is on my side. It's great to have you here and that you take the time. I know you're a very busy lawyer. You have a really fantastic practice in India down there. So you're one of the leading firms there and you are one of the leading lawyers. And so I highly appreciate that you take the time. And I know it's close to your financial year today. So you are very, very busy. And I'm very grateful and thankful and also very happy to have you here and join this podcast. Maybe if you agree, you can tell us a bit about you and your firm. What are you doing? What is your main practice area?
Sure, Christian. Thank you. I'm Nikhil Vashne. I'm a partner with India's foremost full-service law firm, Cyril Amarchand Mangaldas. So I'm based out of the Delhi NCR office of the firm. My practice is largely, I practice dispute resolution. And I also practice white-collar investigation and sanctions. So that's how I have sort of divided my practice, that half of it is disputes, dispute resolution oriented, be it the criminal matters, the civil matters, the arbitration, direct petitions. And half of my practice is compliance oriented. And that's where the internal investigations, the white collar advisory, the sanctions and export controls practice is something that I take care of, which is more on the advisory side. In fact, we are the only law firm in India which has a full-fledged sanctions practice. We work very closely with the US law firms. Mm-hmm. If and when a client is faced, which is facing sanctions being imposed by the US OFAC. So we work together with the US law firms to see that the client gets the desired relief, which includes the sanctioning. So that's one part of my practice. The other limb of my practice is interfacing with law enforcement agencies. Many of the times when a subpoena or a summon is received from any of the law enforcement agencies, the idea for a corporation or senior management is to distance themselves or to shield themselves to the maximum extent possible from a possible interrogation or an investigation by the law enforcement agency. I, as a lawyer with a reasonable amount of experience, on many of the occasions, we do the interfacing with the law enforcement agencies, the specialized ones, the sophisticated ones, and the other local level police authorities as well. So that's another part. The third part is the internal investigations, which is a very important part of my practice. Mm-hmm. Because with the FCPA and the UKBA, which have held the field for many, many years, the corporations in India and their Indian subsidiaries have take these issues, the ABAC issues or the ethics compliance issues very seriously. So if and when there is a situation and we are supposed to do the internal, we handhold the client for the entire internal investigation process together with a firm which does the forensics. And we take it to a logical conclusion. If there are necessary filings to be made with the ministries or any other regulator, we do that. Mm-hmm. We help them do so. And then, if at times there are situations which are more complex in the sense that there are law enforcement agencies also looking into the issue, and in parallel, there's an in-house internal investigation happening. So we navigate all of this together with our clients. The last part is the dispute resolution, which is I started as a disputes lawyer. Mm-hmm. And of late developed niche in the white collar and the investigation space. So disputes is very close to my heart. So, and be it civil or criminal or commercial matters, which we may have domestic or cross-border element involved. We do the advocacy before the courts and the tribunals by ourselves. So that's what I do for my living.
That's a lot. So it's a very great and
In fact,
extensive
if I may
practice.
just talk about the firm also, we are the foremost full service law firm. India's premier full service law firm in India, with offices in New Delhi, Mumbai, Bangalore, Hyderabad, Chennai, and Ahmedabad. We also have two offices in Dubai and Singapore. We are a law firm of almost 1,200 lawyers now, with around 180 partners stationed in various locations. With the You'd name the practice area and you would generally find a partner in our concerned practice area. And so with the size of this kind, and with the cutting and the practices areas cutting across almost all types of practices, you would find a scenario that we are quite well positioned to cater to our clients and provide bring holistic advice to the table. A particular situation may involve several laws, which may be playing their respective roles. So because we have partners in almost all the practice areas, you would find a scenario that we have the ability to bring the holistic advice to the table.
That's fantastic. So, and as we know that you are one of the absolute leading firms in India, so this is very well known. Your work is very well known also worldwide. Today, you have this broad practice, and I would like to discuss, if you agree, the specifics of white collar crime issues in India. In particular, what are the current challenges and developments in this area? So, focusing on this topic today would be great. Maybe you could start with a basic overview of civil and criminal court system in India, just to explain it to our audience, which is not familiar with the Indian system.
Sure, Krishna. So we have two separate set of systems for the civil courts and the session and the criminal courts. Usually, in most of the states in India, the civil and the criminal courts the same, in the sense that the judge hearing the matter would be hearing the matters on the civil side also, and as well as on the criminal side. But in some of the states like Delhi, it is not the case, because if a judge is hearing the civil matters, he would only be hearing the civil matters. If a judge is hearing the criminal matters, he would only be hearing the criminal matters. But largely, the position in India is that the judge would be hearing both kind of matters. On the civil side, if I start with, we have the Civil Judge Junior Division, which has a very small and the pecuniary jurisdiction varies from state to state. So if it's a case which involving a disputed amount of, let's say, 1 lakh or 2 lakh or 5 lakh, depending on the state, those matters would go to the Court of Civil Judge Junior Division. You would institute a suit before the Civil Judge Junior Division. If it's an amount which is a little higher, it would fall before the Civil Judge Senior Division. Then you have the Additional District Judge Court, which in some states is also known as the District Judge Court. And the District Judge Court is the court wherein which in most of the states have the unbridled jurisdiction, in the pecuniary jurisdiction, in the sense that if it's a suit of 1,000 million USD, that will also be instituted before the Civil District Judge Court. The District Judge Court can act in two fashion. It could act as an appellate court to the judgment passed by the Civil Judge Junior Division or Civil Judge Senior Division, or it could act as the original court for a suit or for a civil proceeding which is beyond a particular amount. Then we have the High Court, in one which is one in each state, and then the final court of the land is the Supreme Court, which is the final court of the land. The High Court, of course, like in a state like Delhi or in a jurisdiction like Bombay or Madras, you have these courts also have the original jurisdiction. So if it's a suit or a proceeding involving an amount beyond a particular amount, the suits would may be instituted in those courts. But otherwise, largely in India, the district courts have the unbridled pecuniary jurisdiction. But in some states like Delhi and Bombay, like I state, the situation is a little different. These courts also are the original courts. And then, of course, the Supreme Court is the final court of the land. Many of the times, what we see is that a suit may have been instituted in the Civil Judge Junior Division Court. It may ultimately end up in the Supreme Court after 20, 30 years down the line. So that's on the civil side. On the criminal side, the first court is the court of judicial magistrate first class, which basically hears matters, criminal matters, which could have punishment for 3 years or lesser to 3 years. The judicial magistrate first, generally the first designation that a judge has is the civil judge junior division cum judicial magistrate first class, or civil judge senior division cum judicial magistrate first class. Then the second designation that you have is the chief judicial magistrate, which is the first among the judicial magistrate first class. And he has a jurisdiction of deciding matters up to 7 years of punishment. The chief judicial magistrate is also a very important designation because he's the administrative head of the magistrates in a particular district. Then you have the sessions court, the district in the sessions court. When the judge is hearing the matters on the civil side, he's called to be a district judge, and when he's hearing the matters on the criminal side, he's known to be the sessions judge. And then after sessions court has the unlimited power to, even impose life imprisonment or the penalty to a particular accused, depending on the gravity of the offense. And thereafter, you have the High Court and the Supreme Court, which again, like I said, High Court, you have only one High Court in each state, and then there is only one Supreme Court in the entire country.
Okay,
So, yes.
so it goes through the different various courts. How long does a criminal proceeding take in India?
There have been multiple issues of under trial prisoners and all of these cases that Indian courts have been faced with. Luckily, we had recently had a new criminal laws in place, which provides a specific timeline within which these cases are to be decided. Otherwise, there have been scenarios that, a criminal case instituted, a criminal case filed with the Court of Judicial Magistrate First Class may take 2 years, 3 years, 4 years. The civil matters take longer duration. The criminal take a little lesser. But yes, we have personally done matters wherein an appeal was filed. A criminal appeal was filed in 2014, but the decision came only in the first week of January 2025. So you can
That's
understand
good.
the. So, but now things are changing, and like I stated, that we have now recently had the new criminal set of law, criminal laws that have come in the country, and which have now brought in the timeline concept. Although it is too near, it is too early to say if it is serving the purpose because the timelines are a lot crunched. While of course the intent is good, but it is yet to be seen if those timelines are something which the courts would be in a position to meet, because Indian courts are inundated with lawsuits and pleadings. So you may find a situation that a judge has as high as 120, 130 matters being listed on a particular day.
Okay. And Germany, it's similar. It's a lot of cases for each judge. Takes some time. Maybe we can elaborate a bit on the similarities and differences in the court system, in particular to the United Kingdom. How is it similar or how is it different?
India and UK, of course, have had historical ties. India used to be a British colony at one point, and of course, we got independence in 1947. So some of the we of course follow the common law system. We have quite a few similarities, but we have quite a few differences also in that sense. We after this There was a very famous case of KM Nanavati, state of Maharashtra. This was in 1970s when we parted ways with the jury system. While I understand that the jury system, so we do not have a ju we do not have the jury system in India anymore, but we understand that that continues to be the position in the UK. The second difference in terms of hierarchy of the ports, if I may tell you, is that they have the court of appeal also in the entire hierarchy of courts that they have, and they have specialized appellate and trial courts such as the you know the court, this court of appeal, the Supreme Court, the High Court, including the Queen's Bench, the Chancery, the Divisional. So all of this is not there with us. While we do have specialized criminal courts for a particular legislation, like we have special courts hearing matters for economic offenses or special courts hearing matters for money laundering cases or prevention of corruption cases.
That's very
But
interesting.
but yes, they have an additional layer of court of appeal which is absent in India. That's one another point besides the fact that you know that the jury system is something that they you know that they follow and we don't. And in their country, as I understand, the civil case would usually start in the county court, and then you know they would have appeals to the High Court and then to the Court of Appeal, and it could lie to different divisions of those courts. So that's the you know that's something about their jurisdiction. And in fact, there is some difference as regards the personal, insofar as the personal laws are also concerned, because in India, we do have a certain set of personal laws. Depending on India being a secular country, we have different set of laws for different for different set of people who follow different who have insofar as the personal laws are concerned, which we understand is not the case in the UK.
Okay. So talking about these laws, so as regards to criminal law, what are the major criminal laws that are applicable in India, in particular as regards white collar crime laws? What is the most?
So I'll just give you a generic set of criminal laws, and then I'll talk about the white collar crime laws in particular. So the procedural law in India remains the same, which used to be called the Code of Criminal Procedure up until now, but with the new set of laws, it is now known as Bharatiya Nagrik Suraksha Samhita of 2023, which is BNSS. That's what we call the substantive penal law is the Indian, it used to be the Indian Penal Code, which was drafted by Lord Macaulay in 1860s, and we continued to have that law up until 2023, and that's when the new set of law, which is the Bharatiya Nyaya Samhita 2023, came in, replacing the IPC, which we call PNS. The procedural law is the BNSS, and the third law is it used to be the Indian Evidence Act of 1872, again a colonial law, which now is now replaced by the Bharatiya Sakshi Adhiniyam of 2023, and that's what we call the BSA. BSA is more applicable on both civil matters as well as the criminal matters, because it basically lays down the as to how an evidence has to be led. So it is applicable both on the civil and the criminal side. So that's the general set of laws that are applicable in India. But now talking about the white collar crimes, we have, like I will taking a cue from what I stated earlier, we now have different set of laws, specific set of laws for a specific situation. We have the Prevention of Money Laundering Act 2000, which is perhaps the most, which is at times at a particular point of time, and that situation has only recently changed, was seen to be a little draconian because of the bail conditions, and because it touched upon the it made bail securing of a bail very very difficult. And the evidence is also is the law of evidence is also on is you know is a little topsy-turvy in that particular legislation. So the Prevention of Money Laundering Act deals with the cases of money laundering. We have the Prevention of Corruption Act 1988, which deals with the corruption matters. India at very recently, and this was in 2018, we had a major overhaul of the Prevention of Corruption Act 1988, and the liabilities on the commercial organizations as well as on the commercial organization as well as their senior management was fixed. in that particular law, bringing it in line with the other extraterritorial laws. Our Prevention of Corruption Act, while does not have the extraterritorial application, but the provisions are far more, you know, strengthened and with a very little scope of defenses being available. So that way it is.
Very interesting. You mentioned the money laundering, or money laundering is a very serious issue. It touches various jurisdictions. How is this issue of money laundering dealt with in India in particular?
So India is a party to the is of course the FATF compliant, and we got our law in 2002, the Prevention of Money Laundering Act. We have the agency called the Directorate of Enforcement, which basically deals with the investigates the issue from the PMLA perspective, and from the and from the FEO Act perspective, which is the Fugitive Economic Offender Act perspective. We have the provisions of the law. This particular law are a little different from the other set of laws. In the sense that, you know, that securing bail is more difficult, and even at the time of bail, you have to, the judge has to satisfy himself on the primarily on the merits of the matter as well. Then the evidence, the burden of proof is another scenario wherein, you know, there's a difference, because in this case the burden of proof is not on the prosecution but on the accused. Okay. Is very different from the other set of laws that are applicable in India, and many of the provisions of this legislation were tested before the Supreme Court in a very celebrated judgment of Vijay Madan Lal Chaudhary. That's when the three judge bench of the Supreme Court, which is called the full bench of the Supreme Court, passed a decision almost upholding most of the provisions of the law that were in challenge, which gave a teeth to the agency, the investigation agency, which is the Directorate of Enforcement. After that judgment, which had come in 2023, June 2023, there were instances in India wherein, it was almost becoming impossible to secure bails if somebody is facing a charge under the PMLA. But that situation has recently of late changed with a series of very helpful and very naive and very personal liberty oriented decisions that have been passed by the courts across India, including the Supreme Court, and that that there has been a recent shift. This judgment of Vijay Madan Lal Chaudhary is again being reviewed by the Supreme Court. Perhaps there may be a lot of activity after the judgment comes in, because when the judgment originally came in 2023, the provisions were upheld, and like I said, it gave a lot of teeth to the agency. But yes, things have changed, and now we also see scenarios wherein bails are granted in these matters. In fact, we have done a couple of them wherein somebody who was incarcerated for more than a year and a half and was facing a charge under the PMLA, we secured bail. So now those things have changed. At one point, it was very difficult. Now it isn't. It continues to be. I won't say it isn't, but the parameters have changed. The courts also look into the personal liberty aspect while deciding a bail application. And the one unique aspect about our PMLA, the Prevention of Money Laundering Act, is the fact that it requires a scheduled offense. Now, what is a scheduled offense? There are a particular set of provisions which are set out in the legislation. There necessarily needs to be a case registered in one of those cases. And only when there's a case registered or there's an FIR, that we call it the first information report, which is by way of which the investigation commences in a particular matter. Only in that scenario, the PMLA could kick in. It can't be a situation that I write to a letter to the ED today, the Directorate of Enforcement, and they start looking into the issue. There has to be a scheduled offense. So that's the necessity for the provisions and the PMLA to kick in.
That's very interesting. And also you mentioned that a new set of criminal laws have been recently introduced in India.
Yes.
Maybe you can tell us a bit about the important provisions relating to white collar crime in this context.
Yeah. Christian, the most important law is the Bharatiya Nyaya Samhita, which is the successor of the Indian Penal Code. In the Bharatiya Nyaya Samhita, which is 2023 legislation, there are two, three major developments that have taken place. Point number one being that the cheating and criminal breach of trust, which are the most generic sections that used to be sort of invoked in a white collar matter, because you would say that somebody has cheated you or somebody has breached the trust and this and that. So those are the those two provisions have been there were various provisions dealing with a different scenario, dealing with a different situation in the Indian Penal Code, which is the previous law. Now all of those have been consolidated and have been sort of rearranged in a manner to make it more from the readability perspective. That's one. The second thing is the punishment has gone up so far as the cheating and criminal breach of trust is concerned. We also now have a situation wherein for softer offenses like defamation, there was a lot of UN cry in the country that you should decriminalize the law and this and that. By while the decriminalization did not happen, they have now introduced punishments like community service. So you won't be put with bar. So if the court deems appropriate, they could only leave you with a punishment of community service, of rendering community service. Now we also have a situation like we also have for the first time in the Indian law, the definition of economic offense has been set out in the new BSA, in the new BNS. That was never the case up until now, but now you have a definition for the same. So that's another. And more importantly, and very important thing that has happened is a very one of its kind provision has come in, which is the organized crime to deal with the situation. And this term organized crime was something which was otherwise available in some of the state laws that were there, which was like the Gujarat COCA and the Maharashtra COCA, Maharashtra Control of Organized Crime Act and Gujarat Control of Organized Crime Act. So we have taken some cue from there, and now this provision has now been made available in the BNS also, which is section 111 of the BNS, which basically introduces the term organized crime, which is basically any continuing law of unlawful activity by the effort of group of individuals acting in concert, including as a criminal syndicate engaged in kidnapping, robbing, robbery, vehicle theft, extortion, land grabbing. And then there are whole host of different scenarios that they have talked about, and or any and then it says or any other unlawful means to obtain direct or indirect material benefit, including financial benefit. So two pertinent concepts there. One is the continuing lawful unlawful activity, and that too by an organized crime syndicate, both of which have been separately explained in the said provision. So that's a very important thing that has happened in the law.
Yeah, that's very important. Also to investigate larger groups. And talking about corruption laws, anti-corruption laws, how is corruption in commercial organizations dealt with in India?
Yes. So I'll go back to my previous statement wherein I said that our Prevention of Corruption Act 1988 underwent a major overhaul in 2018. And that's when things started changing. For the first time in the Act, we brought in two very important things. One is we made even offering of bribe a crime. Okay. Up until 2018, it was dealt with by another legislation, which used to be the Indian Penal Code, Section 120B, the criminal conspiracy. But thereafter, in 2018, for the first time, we made giving of bribe also a crime. As much as the public servant would be liable, so would be the person who is offering the crime, who is offering the bribe. But there was an exception carved out that if you sort of go back to your authorities within 7 days and inform them that this has happened, then perhaps there could be a There could be a sort of defense that could be taken that, in order to ensure that the charges are not applicable, are not do not you are not charged for the same. The second very important thing that happened was the commercial organizations for the first time were being made liable for a rogue act of an employee. So up until now, what used to happen up until 2018, what used to happen was if somebody has offered some bribe to, let's say, a public servant, in that scenario, only that particular employee used to be liable. Now, what changed after this was after the 2018 amendments was the liability can now fall on the organization also, commercial organization by virtue of Section 9 of the Act, and it can also fall on the senior management of the company,
Ah,
which is
that's
under
very
Section
strict.
10. Which is under Section 10. So for a rogue act of an employee who you may not even be aware of that what he is doing in a remote location where you are, let's say you have an office. But now for a situation like this, you could find the company and its senior management being made liable for the same. And so that has changed. In fact, there's an inbuilt defense in the section which says that, if the company or the corporate could show, or the commercial organization could show that, we had all adequate procedures in place, all adequate measures in place, and they could sort of distance themselves from a particular act, that could be a defense. But yes, for this, this was the most unique aspect of our PC Act, that, that things changed significantly after 2018. And that's also the case. That's when, your corporations, your companies have started taking the PC Act trainings, the Prevention of Corruption Act trainings, and the ABAC trainings a lot more seriously in the Indian jurisdiction.
Okay, understood. So this is more or less an important factor also in doing compliance programs to have a defense argument in this law.
Yeah, in fact, yeah. So in fact, though, like I said, the compliance programs are very critical. And that's what we also inform our clients, inform corporates, that please do not take it as a tick in the as a tick tick in the box. These trainings have a lot more to do, and because it is not just a training, it is very essential that all your employees are equipped and being informed of the serious repercussions that may follow, and they are being informed by way of an exemplary section where we sort of try giving examples as to what would fall in a what would constitute a crime under the PC Act and what may not. And of course, PC Act is one thing meant insofar as the corporates which have their parent offices in the US and the UK, we also have to see the applicability of the FCPA and the UKBA respectively. And so you have to ensure that your domestic laws, you're being compliant with the domestic laws. And from your parent company perspective, you are also sort of coming across as compliant.
That's very good. And you mentioned the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. With the pause of it currently, how are Indian corporates navigating with this?
So one thing very important is that it is only a pause, it is not a repeal. That's the first thing. What has, in fact, while one good thing that has happened in India is that we have made our own internal mechanisms and the internal laws so stringent and so robust that that a company should ideally not be in a situation, if a corporate is facing a situation like this, they would not want to take the benefit of this. The benefit of the pause, because like the basic underlying factor, it's only a pause and it's not a repeal. So irrespective of the FCPA pause, the domestic enforcement your risk remains very high. You could have a scenario wherein your statutory auditor is informing the ministry, or you could have a scenario wherein a local law enforcement agency is looking into the issue. So all those continues to be in place, and therefore, irrespective of the pause, the domestic enforcement risk remains very high. The in fact, insofar as the let's talk about the US corporations who still continue to have the reporting obligations to their investors and their quarterly, annual, or periodic filings, the internal control driven by US parent with let's say with accounts of Indian subsidiary are getting consolidated. So the SECs, the Securities Exchange Commission interest cannot be ignored. And then you also have those cooperation credit scheme that the US has. If you sort of voluntarily disclose it to them at a particular point of time, so you would want to continue doing so in order to make those in order to sort of benefit out of those cooperation credit schemes. So I mean, insofar as the Indian, while we continue to navigate this because this is unprecedented, but yes, our advice continue, what has happened in India is that we have now luckily made our domestic enforcement so robust, and we continue to continue. It's a work in progress always. That perhaps it is always better to sort of come across as compliant,
No, that's true.
opposed to without with not taking any shelter under any of those repeal or in any of those processes that have happened.
Similar in Germany. You mentioned that you'd also conduct internal investigation a lot. Maybe you can, this is always of high interest. How is the concept of privilege working in India in these internal investigations?
So we used to have a provision called Section 126 of the Indian Evidence Act 1872. That's where the entire law of privilege used to exist. Now, of course, the Indian Evidence Act has been replaced with the Bharatiya Sakshi Adhiniyam, and we have a similar provision, which is now 126, is now 132. So the privilege is always, the attorney-client privilege is something which is recognized in the Indian law, and I think it is very much similar to maybe to most of the jurisdictions when this privilege exists. So more importantly, what is important is that at this point as we speak, this privilege is only with the lawyers and it is not with the in-house counsels. So that's point number one. And the rationale behind is it that while he may not be licensed to practice as advocate under the Advocates Act 1961, and at times they also performed the non-legal work, and it is difficult to establish that the dominant purpose was legal advice or litigation. So only the lawyers have it. Okay. But I can extend it attorney-client privilege by, let's say, if there's a forensics to be done. I am giving a client facing an issue if he directly engages a forensic agent. So whatever the work product the forensic agent comes up with, it may not be privileged, and the investigation agencies may ask for the same. But if it is the if there's an attorney-client privilege, there's the original agreement is with the between the client and the between the client and the lawyer, and the lawyer then sort of engages a forensic agent for, let's say, to the forensics, then perhaps we take it that it ex you know it then ex you know there's an extension of attorney-client privilege in that case.
Makes sense.
Therefore, all the work products that are generated would be protected by way of the attorney-client privilege. In fact, this question of it, in fact, insofar as this in-house counsel versus the lawyer issue has been even tested before the courts. The courts have been consistent in the view that that it only extends to lawyers. However, there is some change which is on the anvil in this regard. But at this point, as we speak, only the lawyers have it with their clients.
Similar in Germany. That's really good to know, in particular in concepting such an internal investigation. You also touched, and this is a topic that's very important for all of us now, the sanctions issue. So maybe you could give us a short overview about sanctions regime in India.
Sure. So India does not maintain an autonomous sanctions regime or a consolidated list of sanctions. We implement it. We implement the sanctions imposed by the United Nations through the United Nations Security Council Act that we have, the 1947 legislation. In that legislation, the government of India is authorized to take any measure to give effect to any decision of the United Nations Security Council. This is done by notifying the amendments to the applicable foreign trade policy. That's one. There's this another aspect of the DGFT, which is the Directorate General of Foreign Trade, which is within the Ministry of Commerce and Industry of the Ministry of Commerce and Industry of the Indian government, which is responsible for the Indian central government on the formulation of the FTP. which stipulates the sanctions regime in India. The DGFT is also responsible for carrying out the FTP and implementing the provisions of the relevant legislations. Further, all the matters relating to the interpretation of the FTP, the decision lies with the DGFT, and that decision is final and binding. Now, presently, India regulates trade with Iraq, Iran, North Korea, and Somalia, and prohibits trade with organizations like ISIL, also known as Daesh, which is the Islamic State of Iraq and Levant. And again with Al Nusrat Front and other individuals, groups, or undertakings and entities associated with Al Qaeda. And we also have a separate list of terrorist organizations and individuals pursuant to the Unlawful Activities Prevention Act of 1967. US sanctions, of course, because US has this say secondary sanction angle. Now, what we are facing, we are seeing in we are witnessing in India is that there are scenarios wherein the US OFAC has been sanctioning the Indian persons and the entities also. And that's where we work with the firms to sort of do what all is necessary for a particular client to get them the sanction or move an application and do the advisory relating to that. So that's how it is in so far as sanctions is concerned in India.
Ah, super. Thank you very much. So, Nikhil, this was really great. Fantastic overview about all these issues covering white collar crime in India. Thank you very much for your time. It was a pleasure
Thank
to talk to you.
you. It was a pleasure, Christian, and I hope the audience would have found it engaging and useful. And thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah, I think the audience will really be interested. If the audience or any listener of us has questions to you, of course, we will put your contact details in the show notes so they can contact you directly. And if there are any questions they want to direct via me, please feel free to contact us also at info@usinus-on-air.com. Thank you very much, Nikhil, for
Thank
being
you.
here. It was a really pleasure having you here.
Thank you. Thank you.
Bye bye.
Der Podcast stellt lediglich einen allgemeinen Überblick über rechtliche Themen dar und ersetzt selbstverständlich keine Rechtsberatung zu konkreten Fragestellungen im Einzelfall. Bei Fragen wenden Sie sich an Rechtsanwältinnen und Rechtsanwälte Ihres Vertrauens, natürlich auch gerne an uns. www.rosinus-on-air.com oder unter www.rosinus-partner.com.